Hi everyone, welcome to yet another episode of Miles the Word. Today we have an incredible guest with us and an intro to whom I will share with you guys in just a mo. But before then, let me introduce or remind you, rather, of the host for today. So that's myself, Aretha. I'm an econ grad. I'm currently working in the world of finance. Boring, I know. But we move. And we have a co-host alongside myself is Nizha.
Hi everyone, my name's Nizha. I'm a final year at UCL studying history and philosophy of science, which is based at the Science and Technology Studies Department.
Awesome. And without further ado, we would like to introduce our incredible guest, Rahima Begum from Rest of Beings. Rahima Begum is a London-based artist, consultant and activist. She is the founding director of an international human rights organisation and grassroots movement, Restless Beings, which is dedicated to supporting the world's most marginalised communities for over a decade. Restless Beings occupies a space between activism, academia and advocacy. Rahima is the driving force for numerous human rights projects, ranging from her work with survivors of bride kidnapping in Kazakhstan, leading to national legislative changes, to championing the rights of the Rohingya community across South and Southeast Asia for a decade. Her activism has always placed human dignity and agency right at the front and the centre.
I think you've described me really well. So I'm definitely a human rights activist and pretty much an advocate as well. So a combination of the two.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining us today again. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey into the world of human rights activism and you founding this incredible grassroots organisation called Restless Beings.
In terms of my journey, very much like a lot of people, left university frustrated about a few human rights issues across the world and just really felt, you know, having sort of, you know, been on the front line of several protests and campaigns, volunteered for many international charities and national ones, I felt frustrated that I wasn't doing enough and I felt this kind of human obligation to want to do more. And so at the risk of sounding incredibly cheesy, I felt restless about the world. And so I'd finished my master's, studying post-colonial history and literature and kind of pretty angry at the world and felt as if I needed to do more than just, you know, volunteer for a charity in terms of a big charity where I wasn't really doing more than possibly just doing a little bit of fundraising here and there, but I didn't feel it was enough. And that's where I felt that, you know, it was important to engage in the roots of human rights issues and looking at unpacking the ways in which communities, became the center of abuse. And so that's where a group of friends and I got together and thought, right, okay, why don't we just start a blog? Now you have to remember at the time, this was a long time ago, 14, 15 years ago, there was only Facebook. So there was no Instagram, there was no Twitter at the time. And so we were like, look, we've got Facebook, why don't we just start a general blog? Blogs were very popular at the time and widely read. And so we just had an online space where people across the world would submit articles about human rights issues that affected them. It began with just a bunch of students in London. It spread throughout the country. And over the space of a year, we had from sort of 5 readers up to 100,000 almost readers. And that then led to us feeling a little bit like, right, okay, people are just reading and sharing our articles. What else can we do? And we had lots of emails coming through at the end of that year saying, look, will you do something about this apart from just talking? And I think that's when that sense of responsibility came over me and my colleagues. And we felt like, look, we really do need to say more than just talk about the issues. And I think that's kind of my initial journey into the work that we did at Restless Beings and why Restless Beings was born and kind of how I found myself embroiled in human rights.
How did you come to know of the deep-seated issues that are not swamped across the media, mainstream media, yet need to be challenged? Did you guys find out about these issues and gear up and go full attack mode against governments or authority figures in these vulnerable communities? Sometimes as individuals, we learn about an issue and we become very angry and passionate about doing something, are a bit scared to kind of start or kind of second guess ourselves and don't know where to go to, like, build a group of people to build, like, I guess build connections and actually speak about topics and topics that we are passionate about and kind of try to resolve or at least do something about a cause that we're very passionate about. So tell us, what sort of approach did you take in your formative years as an organisation?
I think initially when we started, honestly, we had no idea where it was heading. We just knew that there were a couple of things that we really wanted to do. And that, I think, still is part of our mission statement now. And that is, we wanted to, at the time, we used to say it a lot. We don't use those terms as much anymore, but we wanted to voice the voiceless. And so it was a term that we used a lot 14, 15 years ago. And that was, you know, obviously over time you realize actually these communities are not voiceless, they're just forced silenced, you know, they're just displaced, they're just completely shunned away. And so we were keen to make sure that these marginalized voices were heard. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't us that were saying the stories, although we would pass on these stories came right from the mouths of the people that were at the center of the work that we did, the communities that were marginalized. We wanted to make sure that these issues were not just for people who were interested in human rights. They were not just for researchers or development students. These issues came to everyone's doorstep. Everyone, your auntie, your mum, your uncle, your cat, everyone knew about these issues. And that's how we wanted to function as an organization. And then finally, we wanted to make sure that these issues were at the sort of front and center of mainstream media. So sometimes the abuse of a community is in media for all of one or two days and then it disappears completely. And so for us, it's so important to sustain that for as much as we could. And so those were our key fundamental missions. And we thought, right, in order to do that, we need to make human rights accessible. And I think this is what made Restless Beings quite distinct in terms of what we, the approach that we took, is we decided that in order to make things so accessible to everyone and anyone, we had to use the arts. So we used to organize music gigs, theatre shows, you know, flash mobs, you know, down streets in the UK. And this was a way to bring people in through either entertainment or through something really fun. And essentially, when people got together, they would walk away at the end of the night and they had found out lots of information about human rights abuses that were taking place across the world. And we made that information very accessible. And so as part of our early stage of our journey, it was about making sure that human rights was accessible. As we evolved over the years, I think through the decade, we started to head towards, you know, one of, again, as I mentioned, you know, we wanted to always look at the roots of each of our issues. It wasn't enough to just give food and shelter. We had to do more than that. We had to address the roots so that we can really work towards systematic change. And so, you know, to do that, we had to take the accessibility to another level. And that is when governance and legislative changes were important. And so those things came about, I think, through lots of research. You know, we worked directly with the communities. Alongside that, we were doing research. We were constantly lobbying the government. We were working with MPs. And when I say working, more of it was just hassling MPs to say more. So we were constantly emailing them, writing letters, going to events where we could address them and say, look, listen, can you say more? You know, this is what's happening in this country and we need you to say a little bit more because Britain has a direct involvement with them. They're either trading with them or they're, you know, part of their, you know, policies that were changing in that country. And so that's where our sort of political lobbying kicked in. So it did take a really long time. I don't know if I've answered your question completely, but I guess, you know, one of the big things was that we had to try everything that we could to try and get the human rights abuses that our communities were suffering from at the front and center and, you know, highlighted as much as possible. And that meant working with everyone from your next door neighbor to a university student to, you know, working with government MPs. So absolutely everyone. So we just went full throng with this approach.
The type of work Restless Beings does is very niche. It's primarily focused on marginalised communities and human rights and addressing these human rights breaches and abuse. Why did you not go down the disaster relief and development route, such as Islamic Relief, Save the Children, and there are other charities who are currently working on such projects?
No, absolutely. Really good question there. You know, as part of our original mission, it was to work with marginalized communities. It's still working with marginalized communities. And so in order to work with marginalized communities as effectively as possible, we had to really look at why they were marginalized. And so the obvious things are, you know, they don't have food or they don't have shelter, or they've been displaced or they've been persecuted. But in order to really understand why they're at the position that they are, we had to look at the root issues. A lot of those root issues could be socioeconomic issues. They could be issues to do with land struggle. They could be issues to do with, you know, like the gendered experience or racism and xenophobia. And so as part of that process, we could really understand what the meaning of marginalization for each of these communities was. And it does differ. There are lots of similarities, but it's quite, you know, each of the communities have their own sense of what marginalized, what the feeling of marginalized is. And so that led us into really exploring marginalization as a whole. And I think as an organization, we were really keen to make sure that we were able to do a number of things. So even now, we occupy a really strange space between advocacy, academia, and activism. So we're essentially an activist group. We do lots of research work, and we work very closely with academic institutions across the world. A lot of universities partner up with us, and we exchange research. And we also are advocates. So, you know, we do a lot of policy work. We do consultancy in terms of offering policy advice, and we work towards campaigning towards legislative changes. And that's where our advocacy work comes in. The reason why I think we didn't go down the complete humanitarian relief work, although we have done some relief work and we do sometimes still do it. So, for example, recently in the Rohingya camps, there was a fire. It affected over 80,000 people. We're obviously one of the main organizations working in the Bangladesh Rohingya camps. And so as an organization that's at the front line, we responded immediately because we had the resources to be able to do it. And we have amazing donors and public support who then responded very quickly within a week. And so we do relief work. We don't do it as much. To go back to your question, one of the reasons why I think we decided not to go down the relief work is because there are so many amazing international charities that are doing just that kind of work. I mean, you guys at MAR, Islamic Relief, you know, Oxfam, there's loads of Turkish relief organizations, Doctors Without Borders, to name a few. I mean, there's so many organizations that are doing amazing relief work and immediate humanitarian response. And so we thought to ourselves, right, instead of replicating that, we'll support these organizations. So we still do. Sometimes what we do is we actually would allocate a small amount of funds and actually give it to another big charity for any relief work if it comes to any major response. So we've done this before when there was a flood in Pakistan about 6 years ago. We've done these kind of things before. We've supported the rebuilding of a hospital for Syrian refugees in Lebanon, and we did a flash campaign for that, and we worked with other organizations. So we do provide some sort of relief support, but essentially we thought, right, okay, what is an area that isn't being covered enough? 14 years ago, as a small grassroots organization that started off from a blog and then transformed into a British charity and then an international movement, for us it was priority to be able to do the things that international organizations were not doing enough of. And I mean, there were organizations like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch that were, but we felt that it wasn't grassroots enough. And so for us, it was about looking at, you know, what the communities are suffering from, looking at it holistically. And what I mean by holistically is when a community is suffering, we need to look at 360 degrees of why they're suffering, who brought them in the situation that they're in, what do they need, and how much of it do they need, and when do they need it, and what do they hope for? What is the most dignified response? And so in order to address the roots, support communities holistically, you have to take down the other route. And the other route is, as an organization like us, which is grassroots, which is small. Now, of course, we've grown, but essentially a small grassroots organization, we were very nimble. We were able to do the kind of work that larger international organizations were not able to. And so an example of that would be, a major international organization might work with street children in Bangladesh. And that what they might do is provide an orphanage, give them, you know, shelter, food, education, etc. What a small, nimble organization like us is able to do is to not replicate what the other organization is doing, but to support them, but also do what we do distinctly and very well. And that is, we look at the street children that are caught up in trafficking. Which street children are working in prostitution? Who has been trafficked into Thailand and India? Who can we help support and help bring them back into Bangladesh? How did the street children get to the streets? Why? Is it because they were hungry or homeless or orphans? Maybe it was because they had abusive parents and they left the village in one part of Bangladesh, ended up in the capital city of Dhaka, and now work in the train station. And then how do we support a child who is addicted to drugs and who doesn't want to leave the streets and actually wants to carry on being a sex worker? What kind of support does that child need? These are the kind of children that major international organizations cannot support because these children often run away from big NGO orphanages, etc., because they want to be back on the streets again. And so that's the kind of work that we're able to do. And then we're able to lobby the government and say, listen, guys, Bangladesh government, you have a child protocol in place. It's actually not the work of charities to support these children. It's the work of the government. You have the money and the resources to be able to support and take these kids off your own streets in your own country. What are you doing? It's not enough. And so that's where we kind of occupy the advocacy space. So that's why I think it's a number of things. We just wanted to work to our strengths. We wanted to do what wasn't being done enough. And we wanted to make sure that in order for change to really last forever, you know, charities shouldn't exist, guys. You know, we shouldn't be here doing what we're doing because human rights abuses shouldn't exist in the world. And, you know, poverty and justice, they should be, you know, access to justice should be commonplace. And so for us, it was important for us to work towards systemic change and to look at all the roots of the issues.
That's interesting. How do you, as Restless Beings, a small charity and a grassroots organisation, how do you approach these children differently to build a rapport and build a sense of trust and a sense of non-judgmental kind of stance, dissimilar to any other large organisation that's gone in to, you know, with a similar goal, which is to support these children, to help them, but perhaps short term? What is it that, what kind of distinguishes, what's the distinction between Restless Beings and their approach to people, the children in the streets, the street children in Bangladesh, the other communities that you work in? What is it that's different about your approach? How is it, I guess, perhaps a little bit more authentic? How do you bring authenticity in your approach, really?
Yeah, of course. I think with every community that we work with, we always go in with one approach. And that is, we are a friend of the community. We stand in solidarity side to side with the community. We don't believe in taking our Western models of development and what we think is the right way to support a community and applying it, because some parts of it might work, most of it doesn't. We really try and put ourselves in a position of consultation, and so we're consultative. So we listen to what the community really needs, but ultimately it's becoming a friend. So when we, you know, I'll give you an example. When I personally met some of those children 14, 15 years ago with my colleagues, I didn't go in there with a big Restless Beings t-shirt on and a whole group of us as volunteers. And, you know, we met the children and played games with them and then recorded a video. That wasn't the approach. Our approach was, we went in as just friends. We went in as people who were interested. We simply spoke to the children when we kept on going back and speaking to the children. And we spent a long time speaking to the children, observing the children, finding out what was the network with the children. And once you build that sense of trust and the children can see that you're not just any other charity that's going to help them one day and disappear the next, or put them in an orphanage but not really listen to their drug addiction or why they cut their arms or why they're actually addicted to having sex every night, because since they were 7 years old, you know, they were being paid money to have sex every night by middle-aged rich men in the capital city, and that's how they ate. That was their money, and now they're addicted to it, but they don't know because they're a child, right? There's a missed childhood there. Mm-hmm. And so for us, we became listeners. That's what we were. We were friends of the communities, and we still are. Our communities trust us in a way. They trust every charity, of course, and every charity does wonderful work. I think with our communities, they don't look at us as a charity. They just see us as a safe space where they can talk to us. And if we can't help them, we'll contact a major organization or another major charity, and then maybe they can help them. But we're always there for them. And I think that's the approach that we take. A lot of the children that we worked with before, when we first initially started our Street Children Project, as an example, would often come to us and say to us, listen, I left home because my dad used to beat me up. My mum, we couldn't afford to eat enough. So my mum would rather feed my elder brother instead of me. And so we would have very little food. I ran away. I mean, you know, these are kids who ran away at 6, 7 years old, and they didn't know what happened. And they got caught up, you know, with really dodgy, you know, groups. And then they'd end up, you know, they'd either get picked up, they'd end up in the capital city. And then we would find out that they would be part of a wider network. So there'd be a pimp who would basically sell the kids onto prostitution or drugs or trafficking and would exploit those children. And then what we would do is, instead of just assuming that the pimps were bad guys, we would speak to the pimps as well. And this took a long time to get to that stage. And so when we spoke to the pimps, we would find out that actually these were also children once upon a time who grew up on the streets, who came from abusive families, who were then abused in the capital city, and then who themselves were exploited, and they had no other option. And so they grew up to become what they became because they were also dealing with trauma. And so I think when you have these re-education programs and you become a friend of the community and that trust is there, you find out very often very sinister and dark realities of how society works. You find out who are the people exploiting them. You know, you'll be surprised to find that police officers and rich government officials would be on the street sleeping with these children. And these same police officers during the day would shout at the kids and, you know, pretend as if they're supporting them. And so these dark networks are quite, they're devastating. And I think that's kind of what propels us to do the work that we do. So that's the position that we take. And I think that's something that I think we'll always keep with us, which is just to be a friend of the community.
Wow. The perpetuating cycle of deprivation and abuse is obviously apparent here. We often forget, don't we, that the very perpetrators of today may have once been the very subject of abuse or the oppressed, not to downplay or the abuse or give them the green card or the green light for what they have done or are doing, of course, but just to highlight how this cycle manifests and will continue to do so if it's not put to a stop. And that's where you guys step in, don't you? You as restless beings talking to these pimps and getting to the root of the issues and supporting even these people, supporting them through your re-education programs is quite refreshing. And it shows the sustainability of the incredible work, but also the work that's really needed, and the communities are desperately calling out for this sort of work that governments, unfortunately, and other figures of authority may not have the capacity to do so, or may just not care enough to do so.
Tell us a little about how you approached high profile authority figures as you learned about the atrocities that were happening in the communities that you now work in.
Do you know what we do? I mean, often we're very angry. We become agitators, right? So as an organization, we find ourselves in very agitating positions. So even with the Rohingya, we were one of the first organizations in Europe and the first in the UK to start campaigning for the Rohingya a decade ago. And so we didn't start that campaign through the most obvious route. We didn't even know that we would work with Rohingya. We actually were working in Bangladesh on our street children project. And then we were informed that there was a bit of a crisis. We knew that there were refugee camps in the southern part of Bangladesh, you know, that were supporting the Rohingya. We had no project with the Rohingya at the time. And we were just curious to know what the state of the refugee camps was, because we were informed that there was some, you know, money laundering that was taking place. There was major organizations were donating rice, but the rice wasn't getting to the refugees. And so we, as a small organization, a very curious organization, felt that we should go and investigate. We did, and as a result, we produced a short, very rough, badly produced, you know, kind of with a dodgy little small camcorder at the time, you know, filmed what was going on in the refugee camps, and it was a 20-minute long film, and then we leaked it to the UK press and the American press when we got back. By leaking it to the international Western press, what that does immediately is it exposes, you know, the Western press are very manipulative anyway. We all know that. And somewhat, I guess so is all of media, and very agenda driven. But what it did immediately is it put pressure immediately on Bangladesh to look at its own refugee camp. Because what was happening was that the Rohingya were there. They've been there for years and years. We've got Rohingya in Bangladesh that have been there for 22 years. But a lot of people will think that it's a new issue that's been taking place in the last 5-6 years. And so they were just not getting enough rice. I mean, people were donating millions of pounds and it wasn't getting to the community. And so we exposed, through this expose, we were also able to talk about the Rohingya that was coming through the Burmese border, through the Bangladesh-Burma border, and were finding themselves in the refugee camps. We were able to track down some more villagers who had their villages burnt and were escaping and coming into Bangladesh. And so off the back of that, we ended up developing our Rohingya project, because we found ourselves very much involved with the crisis and felt moved by what was happening and felt that we were able to support them as much as we could. By getting the mainstream press on board, it meant that we could take the campaign further and we could make it an international campaign. And then we kept on pestering the mainstream media. Now, what that does is it really puts us in a very difficult position, because it exposes us to government. I'm sure the Burmese government hate us and don't like the work that we do. I'm sure the Bangladesh government probably have problems with us as well. Although so far they've been very supportive of most of the work that we're doing. But what it does do is, as an organization who are constantly agitating, who are constantly telling MPs and telling government officials that, listen, you're not doing enough. We attend, you know, a bunch of APPG meetings. We contact, you know, leftist, right organizations and say, listen, guys, what are you all doing? You know, what are you doing? You're making so much noise, but what are you doing for the human rights abuses of so many of the communities that we work with and also other people work with? And so it's a very difficult journey because a lot of the times we have closed doors. You know, people are not interested. They don't want to say anything. They'll only say anything if it falls into their, you know, ministerial or their political agenda. And so sometimes MPs might go, all right, I'll talk about the Rohingya because it might make them look great for a particular campaign they're running. And that's okay as long as they are talking about them. And so we really look at the frameworks that exist and see how we can make them work to the best of our capabilities to work for the communities that are at the heart of the work that we do. It's a really difficult position. A lot of the time the response is not very positive. Over the years, as we have grown as an organization, as we've been constantly persistent and vocal, over the years, we have seen that suddenly they are now opening up a little bit more. They're listening a little bit more. We are now sometimes offering, you know, consultation work, you know, where we're suggesting to even major NGOs and INGOs, we're saying, listen, guys, you know, you need to fix up on how you're supporting these vulnerable communities. You know, you need to change some of the models that you're using or the frameworks or how you're providing relief. You need to adjust that. You need to do it in a much more dignified way, where it looks at the refugees' dignities, for example. When it comes to the Bangladesh government, we're still in conversation. We're still hassling them about why they haven't got their streets off their capital cities, why they haven't got the street children off their streets of their capital city. You know, there are over 450,000 street children in Dhaka alone, just in Dhaka. Like, imagine how many there are across the country. That's a worrying number, and it's constantly increasing. It's probably now in the 600,000 mark, I'm sure, if I check, but it's worrying. And so we're basically like the thorn that's constantly pricking officials and systems. And I guess that's the best way I think I can answer your question.
Okay, I feel like you've already touched upon this, but I'm intrigued to know a little bit more about the responses from the two different governments, two restless beings. Of course, Bangladesh and Myanmar having very different political institutions and ways of doing things, corruption being something that's probably the only common ground and unhidden, unfortunately. Human rights abuses in Myanmar that have been ongoing for many, many, many years now, yet the media coverage, especially in within the mainstream media, has been very limited, except for when there's an emergency uproar from time to time, as was with the case with the widespread fire that you mentioned, rightly, that took place not so long ago. The fire being one example, having numerous health complications, fatality and even death that can be caused from it. What's the response been over there? And more importantly, what's the correlation or the relationship between human rights abuses in the different resource poor settings and vulnerable communities that you work in? So not just in Bangladesh and in Myanmar, but across the different projects that you have. Do you feel like there's a correlation between human rights abuses and health? Is there some sort of correlation? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, of course. Okay, so in terms of our Rohingya project, I mean, we work across, we work with a number of marginalized communities. So we work with farmers in Punjab, we have a Rohingya project, we have a women's rights project in Kyrgyzstan, where we look at bribe kidnapping issues, we work with street children in Bangladesh, we have a citizenship issue project in Assam, in northeast India. So our projects are always centered on marginalized voices, marginalized struggles, and the communities that are either forgotten or brushed aside by, you know, international communities or international media, or just not aware of, really, issues that not everyone knows about, but that have existed for a long time. For the Rohingya, we started off, like I said, we leaked a documentary. After that documentary, we were able to take the campaign forward and turn it into the international campaign alongside a number of other organizations that we are part of a coalition with, and propel it to what it is now. There's still a long way to go. You know, there are over a million Rohingya in the Bangladesh refugee camps. There are hundreds and thousands of Rohingya spread out across Indonesia and Malaysia. We work with the Rohingya in Malaysia and Indonesia as well. We were the organization that provided female security guards for the women's only refugee camps in Indonesia when the first boatload of refugees arrived there. And so we've been kind of very active and on the ground for the last decade plus working with the Rohingya. Often when we are speaking about a community that is kind of thrust into the news and is struggling with sort of quite genocidal regimes, I mean, we have to look at the Rohingya as victims and survivors of genocide, current day, modern day genocide, which is still happening now. There are Rohingya who are still fleeing Burma. When it comes to any issues that revolve around genocide, it's a very sensitive, difficult, complex topic. And so governments have to be, you know, consulted and spoken to, or, you know, agitated. We have to look at institutions of justice. So we are still fighting for accountability and justice for the Rohingya community. And that's something that's going to continuously go on. For us, when it comes to speaking to governments, a lot of the times, you know, there's resistance initially anyway. So we have held over the last 10 years, we have held, I can't even tell you the number of protests we have held either outside the Bangladesh government embassies. We've in the UK, also in Bangladesh, outside embassies, the Burmese embassies in London. We have held protests asking for a number of things. We're calling for not just the accountability and justice, but also the visibility of the crisis as well. So those protests have often put the kind of pressure that needed to be put at the time in order to make this a mainstream issue, in order for it to be an international issue. Now it is an international issue. Sometimes mainstream media are responsive and might talk about it. Like you mentioned, Arifa, that, you know, when the fire happened, international media did respond. The Guardian had an article, or, you know, the BBC mentioned it. And so that's a great thing. A lot of the time, though, these issues are marginalized and pushed away and brushed under the carpet. And so it's our work to constantly try and, you know, push the agenda with these mainstream media and mainstream governments and try and get them to really continuously care about these communities. That is a long haul for us to do. And there is a lot of resistance that we get. Sometimes people are very responsive. The British government, the approach that we took with the British government is we said, listen, guys, you are involved in the suffering of the Rohingya community. When we addressed the British government, we were the ones that were campaigning and protesting. The British government did listen. They actually stopped. And then that funding towards the Burmese military and military training stopped. And so they were responsive. That doesn't mean the British government is always responsive, because of the British imperial colonial divide and because of their involvement, the Rohingya are in the case that they are now. The suffering is directly linked to the suffering, to the imperialism. So we use those lines a lot when it comes to dealing with governments, when it comes to asking for accountability, when we ask for support. In terms of health, look, a lot of the communities that we work with are poverty-stricken, extremely, you know, traumatized. So an example would have to be, you know, Rohingya children and Rohingya women. Some of the Rohingya girls and women that have come through, when I say some, I mean the Rohingya camps, 1 million plus in Bangladesh, 60% plus are Rohingya women and children, of which the majority of Rohingya women have either been sexually abused, seen sexual abuse and barbaric killing of their husbands, their fathers, their mothers, or have been abused in some way and used as tools. So when it comes to gender-based violence, when it comes to rape, these are all tools of genocide. And Rohingya women and girls and young boys have experienced this in the hands of the Burmese military. And so when they've come into the Rohingya camps, they're dealing with trauma. And then on top of that, they're dealing with not enough food. And they're dealing with, you know, water issues and cleanliness, access to water as well. They have to walk for ages and queue up for hours in order to get clean drinking water. They're also dealing with paranoia from the recent COVID scare that we've had in the last year. So that, you know, there's heightened, you know, fear and heightened scaremongering that's taking place within the camps. And then there's also abuse that continues on in the camps in any poverty-stricken refugee situation. And so these are the kind of health, direct health issues. Malnutrition is a big one. You've got pregnant mothers who are not able to lactate. They're not able to provide breast milk for their children because they're malnourished themselves. And so these are the kind of things that we're often dealing with when it comes to supporting the community that we do. That's beyond sort of the advocacy side of things. It's about just keeping the community alive, making sure that they get, you know, dignified support and the things that they really, really need. And often that is just food, that's just water and someone to listen to them.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Rahima. You've kind of mentioned going in and supporting, but also in terms of most recently with the COVID-19 affecting poor settings that REST has been working, kind of tell us a little bit about how what the lockdown has meant for you as an organisation and kind of having to reach out to these communities, how difficult it's been. I assume that there's been a lack of access to aid agencies for these marginalised communities during this period. Has that been the case? And if so, how has REST been being able to respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think COVID has meant that, you know, for example, as soon as we went into lockdown last March, international, you know, presence of social distancing, new rules, we were all just trying to get our heads around this pandemic, right? So imagine the kind of uncertainty that we were feeling. Now place that in a refugee camp situation. Refugees are already dealing with their trauma. They're already very much poverty stricken and very much confused as to what's going on. They don't, you know, they didn't know what was happening. They didn't know what this virus was. They don't have televisions inside their shelters and radios where they can listen to what's happening. And so all of it was secondhand information. And so we as an organization had to respond in the most effective and most immediate way possible. And that was firstly to inform the communities that we work with about what the virus was. What is it? What they need to do? How they need to socially distance? We then started working towards providing PPE, you know, making sure that the communities that we work with, the Rohingya community especially, had face masks. You know, how can you socially distance when you're living in a cramped 1 million plus, you know, refugee camp where everyone is literally, you know, people's shelters are like 2 meters by 3 meters and it's, you know, completely touching the next shelter. And the shelters are made from bamboo and plastic, not walls. And so you can actually hear your neighbors, you know, even just breathe. And so socially distancing was very, very difficult and impossible in these kind of camps. And so we had to make sure that we were A, providing information, B, trying to reassure the community as much as possible, providing PPE support. And we did that immediately within the month. We provided as much PPE as possible. And then there was this big issue of, because we were in lockdown, international aid agencies, a lot of international charity workers and staff had to leave. So they ended up leaving the camps. And there was a shortage of staff, a shortage of international charity presence. And so that was also problematic. And it just affected the number of refugees that were supported. And so these were some of the crises that we were dealing with as a small organization. We didn't leave. Our team live on the ground. You know, they live next to the refugee camps, our team on the ground. So that was very fortunate. And it just meant that we could carry on doing the work that we could. But unfortunately, we did see a huge reduction of support staff and as a result a huge reduction of you know, food, of charity donations coming through. And as a result, the Rohingya had to really find ways to fend for themselves. And often, you know, there's always an increase in deaths as well as a result of these things. So that's how COVID has affected the communities that we work with.
Amazing work on ground in both Bangladesh and Myanmar. Something I found incredibly fascinating during my research on restless beings is the Alakachu project, the child kidnapping in Kazakhstan, I believe. Can we have you touch upon that a little and your projects in those remote communities, as it's something not plastered across our television sets and our newspapers, of course. And so it may be interesting to shed light upon these issues that may or may not be new to our listeners.
Yeah, no, of course. It's not child kidnapping per se. It's more it's a kidnapping of young girls and women for marriage. So it's bride kidnapping. So this is in Kyrgyzstan. It doesn't just happen in Kyrgyzstan. It happens in many other countries across the world. But Kyrgyzstan and parts of Central Asia, it's very commonplace and it's been happening for hundreds of years as part of the culture. And a huge, I'm talking in the hundreds and thousands, every single year, hundreds and thousands of young girls and women are kidnapped, forced into marriage, and then they have no choice either to escape, but then they're rejected by the community and become social outcasts. And I tell you where this tradition comes from, Arifa. It's basically, there was a long time ago when it was just a romantic tradition. So a boy and a girl liked each other. They wanted to marry each other. They would go back and tell their family. And then the family would make them act out this eloping scene, which was romantic. So horses are a big symbol of Kyrgyzstan. they symbolize freedom and strength and power. And so a boy would come on a horseback, on a horse, and then he would take his girlfriend on horseback and ride off into the sunset. And the families would give them the blessings. And then the next day or that evening, they would have the Islamic nikah. And so this was part of a tradition. Over the years, it has been abused. So it's a lot of it is to do with socioeconomic issues. When a boy can't afford the dowry, instead of trying to do it romantically, he will just pick a girl that he doesn't even know on the streets and he will kidnap her. Sometimes he'll get his friends to help him kidnap her, drag her into the car so she could be walking to work. A lot of the kidnappings take place on the streets. So it's always with a car and a woman who's walking. So they'll drag her into the car, they'll force her and take her home. Sometimes she gets raped, sometimes she doesn't, but instead she gets locked into a room, and then all the women from the guy's side will come and put a white scarf on her, and they will emotionally pressurize her and say, listen, this is part of your culture, you know, your mom, your grandparents, all the women in Kyrgyzstan have been married like this, you're now technically married. Even if this girl is like, no way, I just want to go home, I don't want to be with this guy, you know, she's crying and screaming, they'll force her and lock her up, and they'll keep her overnight. Next day, so the girl's family might be searching for her, and obviously they don't know who the kidnappers are, so they'll be going crazy calling the police. The next day, the guy's family will find the girl's family, contact them and say, listen, she's married to us now, she's spent the night, she's happy. So the girl's family will just be like, okay, cool, this is part of our culture, what can we do? She spent the night there and they just won't take her back. And that is exactly how it's been exploited. And what happens is thousands of girls are then left either in very abusive, unhappy marriages, because sometimes the girls stay in the marriages thinking, this is it, this is what's in my destiny. Some of the girls run away, and then because their family doesn't accept them, they find themselves, you know, working in prostitution or homeless. And then some of the girls do get accepted by their families, but then because of the community and cultural pressures, they sometimes commit suicide. And so these are the kind of cases that we deal with. We were very, you know, very strong on making sure that there were legislative changes. So in Kyrgyzstan, many years ago when we started working on this project almost 12 years ago now, if you kidnapped, you know, cattle, if you kidnapped a chicken or a cow, you got 6 years in jail. But if you kidnapped a woman, like if you stole a cow, basically, you got 6 years. But if you kidnapped a woman, you got only 6 months, and not even sometimes. And so that just shows you where women's rights is and where women's place is in the country. This has changed. We were one of the organizations that were very, very much behind the international legislative changes. It was because of us that we had propelled this case into a wider mainstream situation. So, for example, we created a national television advert, which has never happened in Kyrgyzstan. We worked with one of the best directors in Kyrgyzstan, and we created an advert which was shared across international TV networks in Kyrgyzstan. That literally showed a kidnapping and said, listen, if you've been kidnapped, you can call this number. We work with local organizations. We had a call helpline, so anyone who was kidnapped could call the number. And also we were supporting a couple of shelters where women were escaping to and they needed support. Some of those women were raped and they were pregnant and they were there in these shelters. So we were making sure they had clothing, support, food, etc. And off the back of that, we started a campaign group and across Kyrgyzstan, not just in Bishkek, the capital city, but throughout the rural part in Osh, etc. We started to work with local organizations, local schools. We started to have re-education programs where we were working with young boys and saying, listen, is this how you want to get married? Is this what you believe is love? Do you not think that a woman should have choice? And you're Muslim or whatever religion you are, it's important to look at what the Quran says, what Allah is asking of you, where women's rights is. And so it was very important for us to work with the religious leaders as well and tell them, look, listen, you can't do nikahs for, you know, these marriages because it's not right, it's not halal. And so there was a lot of sort of religious consultancy that we had to do on that grounds, but most of it was working towards changing the legislation. And through the campaigning, through the protests, it took us a good few years, almost 6 years, we eventually were able to change the government legislation where women and girls are now, you know, being kidnapped. They get six, anyone who kidnaps them gets 6 years, as well as the cattle. So we've made it equal. It's still not good enough, obviously, but it's better than 6 months. It's now, since 2013, it's a criminal offense to kidnap a woman, but it still happens now. I mean, there was a case only a month ago where a woman was killed and then she was kidnapped and then killed because she said no. And so it's still taking place in Kyrgyzstan, except now the issue is reducing slowly because the Kyrgyz youth are now waking up. You know, all the hard work that we as an organization and other international organizations that have done over the last 10 to 12 years is now being picked up, and the Kyrgyz youth are now saying more as well. Young Kyrgyz girls and boys are saying, no, actually, we don't agree with this, we don't want this. But there's still a long, long, long way to go, because this is mainly taking place in the capital city, but it's not reaching the rural parts of Kyrgyzstan enough where it takes place the most. And so, you know, our work continues. One of the big things we wanted to achieve, we have with the legislation change, but the next part of our project now over the next 10 years is to see how we can support the rural communities and changing their mind in terms of how they go about this. So it's a very complex, strange, to our ears anyway, issue, but something that's, you know, something that needs to be addressed and does take place in other parts of the world.
That's amazing, because I was going to ask you about how recipes of changing is helping to change the cultural challenge the cultural norms, as you mentioned here. And because it's such a deep-rooted issue, it's been going on for years and years and years, and it's kind of back to history. Something that was so romantic has now just been completely abused and is not romantic at all in the slightest. And I just wanted to know a little bit about, in terms of, like, have you got projects kind of developed or developing in these remote areas now as well as we speak? Or is it something that you're kind of looking forward to doing in the next couple of months or so, or years or so? If there are kind of like other, I mean, the winning on the legislation is amazing. Like, congratulations to you, yourself, and the team out there. And kind of tell us a little bit about, like, the challenges that you faced initially and, like, how you came about those as well.
Yeah, of course. So we actually have already started working in the rural parts. We started working there almost, I think 7-8 years ago. And then around 6 years ago, we made another trip. I think COVID has slowed things down in the sense that we weren't able to make our research trips and our working trips to Bangladesh, to Kyrgyzstan, like we normally do. And so the last year has been difficult because I haven't been able to access, you know, my team and be on the ground myself. And so that does kind of slow things down a little bit. We've actually started working in the rural parts, and we have a couple of partners that we work with, partner organizations, and also we have a small team there ourselves. We've got two individuals, Restless Beings team members, who are actually in Osh and in Bishkek, in Kyrgyzstan. So we have our own presence there, and we've been there for a while. We are working in certain parts of the rural landscape in Kyrgyzstan, but we want to spread it. So because we've already established ourselves there, in the next 10 years, what we want to do, especially in the next 5, is to be able to work in other villages. So that's the next goal, is to be able to take that work that we've successfully been able to do so far and to replicate that in other villages across Kyrgyzstan. So that's the next stage for us, is to work with schools, is to work with religious leaders there on the ground, is to look at other cases, to work with empowering female leaders, and to actually try and find ways in which we can support the communities as best as possible, but without imposing, you know, any cultural norms. It's actually to really listen to what they want, you know, and actually maybe just to say to them, listen, guys, we're not here to say, you know, this Western idea of women's rights and freedom is the way forward, because it isn't. It's to actually say, listen, you had a romantic tradition, why not just return back to it and take the abuse and exploitation and, you know, take the pressure of dowry away from boys? How can we readdress it? So these are the conversations that we want to keep having going forward, and being able to do that in other villages. In terms of challenges, so I mean, in Restless Beings, It's strange. It's crazy, actually. Running Restless Beings with a majority of volunteers, I mean, we were 100% volunteers. And in the last year, we actually now have the ability and funding to have one or two paid members of staff and a couple of interns, which is great because that definitely helps. But majority, 99% of Restless Beings for the last 14 years that we've been running has been predominantly by volunteers. And so one of the biggest challenges, I think, is there's so much to do in each of our projects, and it's very demanding, and the projects are evolving all the time. The community's needs are evolving all the time. And when you're operating on a voluntary basis, you know, be it 99% or 100% voluntary basis, it's very difficult, you know, because especially during, you know, the pandemic year, where everyone is going through loss and everyone is going through a difficult time, falling sick. And so how do you, you know, carry on kind of sustaining that energy and interest in these communities through a voluntary a basis? So that's quite difficult. But our volunteers are incredible, very, very passionate, and they really care. And I think that's why I think we've had some volunteers that have stayed with us. You know, we very rarely refer to them as volunteers. We refer to them as our core team members, and the heart and kind of, you know, the skeletal framework of Restless Beings. They've been with us, you know, many of them have been with us, you know, for 10 plus years or a good number of years at least. And they're incredibly passionate about the work that we do. And so I think, you know, apart from the challenges that come around sort of resources and sustaining volunteer interests, other challenges could be things like, you know, there's in social media right now, you know, there's people are often jumping from one human rights issue to another human rights issue. And there's just so much noise. And that's a good thing. That just means people are caring. You know, we're all exercising empathy and compassion so much more. But it's problematic as well, because what that also happens is sometimes there's a lot of sharing and resharing of issues, but there really isn't any real groundwork, you know, the kind of work that no one really likes to do, which is, you know, the real sustained groundwork. It's staying with the community forever. It's saying, listen, I care about you. I want to see you guys come out of this abuse. And I genuinely care about your future. And I want to stay with you as a committed, you know, member of civil society. And how do you sustain that? And so that long-term support and sustaining long-term support in a crazy social media world right now, where fast news and populist movements are the way forward, it's difficult. It's very, very difficult. So for an organization like ours, which believes that every community that we work with, we stay with that community, even if we succeed and get all of our goals, we will still stay with that community and keep observing to make sure that their human rights are still intact. It's hard. It's a harder work, but it just means we just need to be more persistent and passionate. And that's kind of, you know, the groundwork of Restless Beings. And we also sometimes, the other challenges are, for example, we have a farmers project. And so when you're working with, you know, farmers in a country that is changing so quickly, you know, in a nation that's changing, you know, India with its BJP government and its, you know, xenophobia and its kind of, you know, anti-Muslim and anti, you know, other ethnic minorities living within India attitude and its pro-Hindu, Hindustan, Hindutva kind of agenda. We're dealing with more than just a farmer's protest. We're dealing with, you know, the livelihoods of farmers. We're dealing with identity issues. We're dealing with citizenship issues. We're dealing with what does, you know, being part of a nation look like and feel like, and what is the future of this nation, and where will those communities go if they're being ostracized or if they're being pushed out? And so these are the other kind of challenges that we're dealing with often. You know, we find ourselves trying to support farmers who have had family members commit suicide because, you know, the Indian government wants to prioritize profit and, you know, capitalism over livelihood. You know, how do you then go to that farmer's family and say, listen, guys, you know, we're going to support you, but your country is changing and your country doesn't have enough respect for you anymore because it's heading towards, you know, this agenda which prioritizes one religion, which prioritizes capitalism, this new India. How do you go and provide and that kind of support? How do you reassure those communities? And so it's really, really navigating and working around those kind of things. And I think that's, these are challenges that we have to rise to as an organization and as part and parcel of the work that we do.
Yeah, no, that sounds amazing. I was actually going to touch upon India. Thank you so much, because you've actually mentioned everything that I was actually going to ask about. I did want to say, like, what do you feel is going to happen next with the farmers issue at the moment? Because I know there's been some movement there already. How can we kind of, is there any way that we as a general public can support that movement? What can we do? And all these things that you've mentioned, all the things with Alakachu, with Rohingya Muslims, with the BJP in power and like fascism being, you know, being at the forefront in one of the, you know, the world's largest democracy in the world, essentially. How do we kind of, as a layman, as a person who's kind of not directly involved with an organization at the moment, like, how can we and other students, other people who are quite interested in in human rights issues, how do we, is there something that we can do to kind of, I don't know, help these people and these communities and do something within our own little spaces?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know what? Honestly, you do not need to be directly involved or working with an organization that works with the farmers or any of the communities that I might have mentioned in order to care. And I think, you know, the wonderful work that you're doing at MA, for example, you know, it's so focused on mothers and mothers' livelihoods and supporting those mothers. And that doesn't mean that you can't also, as an organization, use yourself as a vehicle to also mention some of the issues that the farmers might be facing, even if it's outside of your remit. And that's kind of where we as an organization sometimes, you know, we will talk about issues that might not be within our project, but there might be issues that concern us. So, you know, mothers who are suffering, you know, in a part of the world that might not be within your remit could also be conversations that you can speak about because you have the expertise. But generally, beyond the work that you do within MAR or within the organization that you might be affiliated with, as every general member of public, you have access to platforms and you use platforms like social media platforms. You know, you're with colleagues, you're with, you know, your friends and family. One of the things that we always say at Restless Beings is that speak to whoever you can about the issues that come to your ears and do it often, and so that it stays at the front and center of their mind. And so by simply resharing something, by saying that you actually care, by putting out a tweet to say, listen, I stand in solidarity with the farmers, and putting the hashtags in, like the Kisan Majdoor farmers ones and the farmers protest hashtags, that means that the communities, and some of them are the farmers themselves who are using the social media platforms, can see that there's international solidarity. Sometimes that is all that it needs. You don't need to do more than that. Sometimes you don't need to have a project and be on the ground and, you know, directly donate or anything like that. Sometimes it's just simply about saying, I actually, within my feelings, within my empathy, my politics, I stand in solidarity with these farmers and I care. And as someone who works for, you know, a charity that supports mothers, I care about the mothers. I care about the farmers. I care about their livelihoods and I care about their future. And by simply sharing that on social media is an act of solidarity. It's an act of resistance, because nations see that. Nations see social media users are powerful, and nations can see how much, you know, those algorithms and those numbers and those, you know, trending tweets, they all matter. They really, really do. They influence media and they can also influence governance. And so that is how civil society, as members, laymen, you know, regular folk, can just actively show their support. And that's the first step. Obviously, the second step would be to do, you know, with things like find a charity that works with those communities, donate if you can, or reshare some of the content that they're putting out on their social media. They've spent time researching that content and putting it together. And so by you resharing it through your platforms, you're then propelling that information and continuing the education. That is also a huge thing that anyone can do. So those are the two key things I would say.
Well, it's been an incredible conversation. I've learned so much from you, Rahima, and I'm sure our listeners have too. Unfortunately, this is all that time permits us for, and this is where we can draw our conversation to a close. But before I do, I would like to reiterate the point that you've made about activism. Anyone can be an activist. All you have to do is care and genuinely care. Support causes that you care about by using social media platforms and using them as leverage to raise awareness by resharing, tweeting and retweeting and hashtagging to create international solidarity for causes across the globe. Thank you so much again for taking your time out from your busy schedule to share your Restless Being story with us and educating us about the world of human rights activism and your journey into this world and how we as individuals can play a small role in this big world.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.